This is Author Corner Live, brought to you by the Capital Area District Library, recorded at the G. Robert Vincent Voice Library at the Michigan State University Libraries. My name is Nicole Wells, and I'm the Youth Services Coordinator at the Capital Area District Library, and I am speaking to world-renowned author Lois Lowry. Hi, Lois. How are you?
Hi, Lois. Excuse me, I said hi, Lois.
That's okay.
You're Nicole. I'm Lois.
Yes.
I got very flustered because you called me world-renowned.
Well, geez. It's true. Wonderful. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine, thanks.
Very, very good. Well, I am calling today to talk to you about your wonderful books, and I wanted to start right off the bat asking you about your new title, Gossamer, and I was hoping you can tell me a little bit about that.
Well, I'll try to.
Okay.
It's going to be a little difficult because the book isn't out yet. I'm familiar with it, of course, because I wrote it.
Sure.
But I have not yet been out there talking about it, and it's an unusual book, so I haven't quite figured out how to talk about it. I will say that it is both realistic and fantasy, so it's things that I've done both of in the past, but now for the first time in one book.
Mm-hmm.
I created two separate worlds. One is real people in real time in a real house. And then the other is a world of magical type people. I can't think of a better description. And these people touch each other and affect each other without ever knowing each other. And so it was quite a challenge for me, and it was great fun to write. I loved writing this book.
It sounds fantastic. I went to your website, and from the description, it sounds that you delve into the world of dreams a lot. Can you explore why you used dreams and dreaming to tell your story?
Yeah, dreams to start with. Dreams have always been something that fascinated me, the way they do all people.
Mm-hmm.
Such a mysterious realm, the realm of what we dream and why. And so for this book, I created a world of creatures, for lack of a better term, whom I called dream givers. And these are the creatures who give us, obviously, our dreams. And they do so by entering our house at night while we sleep and collecting bits and pieces of our own past and our own memories. And then giving these to us in complicated ways where they're all mixed up and become quite magical. Now, I'm sure a neurologist would tell you that's not how dreams happen.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of a nice thought to think that there might be somebody benevolent out there bestowing dreams on us.
Absolutely. So do you feel in writing this that you got a clear idea in your own mind the difference between, say, happy, fun dreams, goofy dreams versus the bad dreams and the nightmares?
Course, you know, when you're writing fiction, when you're writing a story, there always have to be opposing forces. That's what makes tension in the story. Conflict makes for suspense, and it's what keeps a plot moving along.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, there are the creatures that the author wants you to love, these benevolent dream givers. But at the same time, out there waiting for their chance are the terrible, evil nightmare givers.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a moment, as there's always a climactic moment in a book, when these two forces collide and battle one another. And in this book, they do so for the soul of a little boy.
Mm.
All of my books, of course, have a child character because that's primarily my audience. And in this case, one of the main characters is an 8-year-old boy.
Wonderful. Yes, I love many of your stories. I'm very familiar with them. That's great. Speaking of character, you have such wonderful, colorful, complex characters. Do you usually base your characters, or do you, from a real person that you know, or do you find that you kind of make them up more in your imagination when you write?
That's kind of a tough question to answer because all of my characters are fictional, of course, which
mm-hmm.
means I made them up. That's
sure.
the definition. But you can't make up a character unless you draw on people you've known, on your own self in many instances, characteristics of real people. So none of my book characters that I recall are really completely based on one real human being, and yet all of them draw on people I've known. My own children, my grandchildren, my own self as a child. All of those are in the characters, but they're created. They're combined and created into a fictional character.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Also, you were saying that this new story, Gossamer, incorporates realistic fiction and fantasy. How does that work when you're... Do you develop more... One, let me start again. Do you develop one book at a time, or do you focus on one story? And when you do that, how do you shift, you know, from, in this case, you put them together, but when you do your historical fiction versus your science fiction, even autobiography that you've done before, do you do them, do you have same books going at the same time?
I really do one at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Because a book requires, for the period of time that you're working on, at least the first draft, such intense concentration that to divide that concentration and work on something else half of each day or next week would be very tough for me. I need to move into the realm of the book. I need to, in a sense, in my imagination, live with the characters in the place where they live. And I can't move back and forth to other imaginary realms. So I do one book at a time, and when that one's done, I turn to the next. I may have, while I'm working on a book, ideas for a next one, and I'll jot those down in a folder in my computer, but I'll go back to them later. I won't let my attention turn too much to that, because it's too distracting.
Mm-hmm. So do you find that once you write something, say, realistic fiction, like an Anastasia book, do you feel that you're compelled to shift gears into science fiction, or have you found there's a pattern that you automatically say, you know what, I'm going to go to science fiction?
If you were to look back, you might find a pattern, but I'm not aware of any conscious need to do that. I think what happens is I work on one thing for a while, I become consumed by it and spend my time with it, and then it's done. And then to keep myself from being bored, I don't immediately do the same type of thing again. And so I usually will turn to some other genre. There are plenty of authors who write the same kind of fiction and nothing else, but I seem to be comfortable in not only different genres, but also writing for different age groups. So I might turn from a book for young adults, teenagers, say, to a book, I'm currently finishing one up, that's for primary grades, first through third.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a very different way of looking at things, a different way of writing, and it keeps me from getting tired of what I'm doing and bored with it.
Now, do you feel in your work that there is a theme that binds your stories together, whether they're one genre or another?
I suppose there is, and I think I've said this before and been quoted before, but I guess I keep going back to this, and it's a pretty broad statement. But I think the most important thing that we ever grapple with in this world is our relationship and our connection to one another as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
And by that, I don't mean my relationship to my children or to my husband, but my relationship to all human beings in this world. And that becomes, as time passes and the world seems to grow smaller, I think it becomes more and more important. How am I related, connected to, for example, a child in Africa? And these are things that I think about a lot. And I think that's the major theme addressed in probably all my books. I don't mean specifically Africa, but the connection of one human being to another, how important we are and what we can give and take from one another.
Thus, the dream givers or the nightmare givers or the giver. Come on, we can't forget that.
Yeah.
Jeez. Oh, gosh. I have to say, I read the fantastic speech that you gave last March titled How Everything Turns Away.
And it
was wonderful, and it gave a lot of insight into what fuels your own curiosity and your desire to write. And I was wondering, can you please share your thoughts with us? And it may be related to what we were just speaking about, to turning away or not. And how that feeds into your writing process and the different stories that you tell.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember that speech specifically, but perhaps it doesn't matter whether I do or not. I was talking in that speech about the fact that in my experience with my own books, I've often had to face controversy and challenges and in some cases banning of some of my books because some of them deal with hard issues and there are people who feel that kids should not have to face things that are tough when they're still young. And I think it's more of a mistake to pretend that everything is pleasant and nice, which is the way children's literature was when I was growing up and reading the Bobbsey Twins and Nancy Drew, who dealt with mysteries, but everything was so antiseptic and everything always turned out happily. And of course, real life doesn't work that way. And more, I think today's kids are, I mean, they're looking at television, the news, newspapers. They're hearing about the world, and to pretend that the world isn't a tough place, I think does kids a disservice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I was trying to talk about when I gave that speech, and the title came from a poem I've always admired by Auden, in which he speaks of a painting where Icarus, whose wings you recall in the myth, melted and he fell from the sky. And in the painting, he's fallen from the sky and has fallen into the ocean, and nobody is noticing because they've all turned away.
Mm-hmm.
So I was using that as an analogy.
Yes, that's great. You also mentioned in that speech, I was hoping you can tell the story just to get it on tape, it's fantastic, about growing up in Japan and a certain connection that you made when you were a little girl riding your bike and how that came back years later.
Okay, yeah. And interestingly, I'm going to see Alan next week.
Oh, really?
let me think how best to tell this. Alan Say, most people involved in the world of children's books know this name because Alan Say is a brilliant illustrator of children's books. And he won the Caldecott Medal for a wonderful book called Grandfather's Journey. And Alan Say grew up in Japan. He's Japanese, though he lives in this country now. He and I were speaking at the same conference once some years ago. And he gave me a copy of his book, and he signed his name for me in his book, and he wrote it underneath in Japanese. And so I gave him a copy of whatever book I had with me at the time, and I wrote my name in Japanese, too. He said to me, "How do you happen to write Japanese?" And I said, "Well, when I was a kid, I lived in Japan." And we discussed how old we are, and we're both exactly the same age. Okay, I confess, he's 4 months younger than me. So we were both born the same year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told him that in 1948, 49, 50, I lived in Tokyo. And he said he lived in Tokyo then. And he said, "Where did you live?" And I told him, and he said, "That's where I lived." And to make a long story short, he told me about the school he'd attended, and I said, "I used to ride my bike past a school. I used to look in that playground." I don't know what they called it, playground, but the area around the school, and the kids would be out there in their uniforms, and I used to ride past there on my bike and look at those kids. And Alan looked at me for a minute, and then he said, "Were you the blonde girl on the green bike?"
Mm.
Now, this had been 50 years ago.
Right.
And here we were sitting in the coffee shop of a hotel someplace in the United States and realizing that we had 50 years earlier looked at each other and looked away because the time was wrong. I mean, I was a blonde American girl and he was a Japanese boy in a bombed city and the war had just ended. And so our paths didn't cross until the time was different and right for that. Now we're close friends, and as I say, he lives in Portland, Oregon. I'm heading out there Monday. I'm going to have lunch with him next week.
Wonderful. That's great. Just gave me the shivers. It was amazing. Very cool example of human connection, and
sure,
sometimes
yeah.
The time is right, and sometimes it's not, you know, so that's wonderful. Well, very good. This has been wonderful. I'm so glad that you could talk to me. Before I let you go, though, I am hoping that if you have any more news about the movie The Giver, of which you were just referring with Jeff Bridges.
Well, I just by chance, before I talked to you, I was talking on the phone to Jeff Bridges. The movie has been sort of in the works, but not really, for years. He and I were trying to remember how many years. 10, I think. And suddenly it's ratcheted up a notch, and now they have a director and a screenplay, and so they're going forward. He hastened to remind me that these things sometimes fall apart, even this late in the game, but he's hopeful, and I'm hopeful that that won't happen. And I told him, yes, I could see him with a beard. If he wants to be the giver, I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know a lot of times when the books get optioned, they kind of just go. You just kind of option them out, and then they're taken creatively in another direction or a similar direction. Do you have insight into what might happen with this movie at this point, or is it kind of out of your hands?
Well, it's out of my hands. They have no obligation to consult me at
sure.
all. The thing that's really quite wonderful is they have the courtesy to consult me. I had lunch with the director last week, and I had a phone call with Jeff Bridges this afternoon. So they are at least interested in what I have to say.
Excellent.
And aside from that, I'll just sit back and watch it unfold and hope for the best. It's certainly in very competent hands.
Yes, that's wonderful. Very good. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
It was fun.
I was able to meet you when you were here doing our talks for us earlier. We had dinner together. There was a bunch of people.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, it was. I'm very happy to speak
dinner,
with you again.
I don't remember you.
Yeah, that's all right. There are a lot of people there. I don't expect you to. Very
but
good.
It's good to talk to you again.
Yes. Thank you very much, Lois.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.